Imperial Leader, the life story of the foremost man of our time, Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill, First Lord of the Admiralty, has returned from the epic of Antwerp, the scene of another great adventure, an apparent failure which history later shows as a glorious success, when naval brigades under Churchill's inspiration and leadership delay the German advance for 5 days and save the Channel ports from German occupation, thus removing a possible danger of a German invasion of Britain. Back in London, another great epic is foreshadowed, the Dardanelles. But before the first suggestion of this unparalleled and gallant action is considered, Winston Churchill must take leave of one of his oldest friends and truest colleagues.
First Lord, I want you to accept my resignation.
Your resignation, Prince Louis? For what reason?
I think you know.
You possess my entire confidence and that of the government.
But not the confidence of the people.
Oh, if they knew you as I do.
They know only that I am Prince Louis of Battenberg, a German, and an enemy of the country. Why should a man of Teutonic birth, they ask, be allowed to remain in the vital position of First Sea Lord?
No man could have been more loyal than you. None could have performed his duties more ably. I want you to consider your decision.
No. No, my mind is made up. I am in the invidious position of having to take great responsibilities and risks day by day without that support in public confidence to which I am entitled. Such a state of affairs cannot be allowed to go on.
I know there has been criticism. Since the loss of Antwerp and the loss of the naval brigades, the Admiralty has been most unpopular. But now the loss of the Audacious has raised a new outcry. If it is my blood thereafter, Prince Louis, not yours.
I know better than that. There is a constant stream of letters, signed and anonymous, urging me to get out, calling me a Hun and a traitor. I'm shunned in the clubs, insulted in the streets. No, my position is quite untenable.
Stay and fight it out with me.
No, your own position is becoming increasingly difficult. If I remain, it will be 10 times worse. Suppose that tomorrow we receive news of a fresh disaster, even worse than anything we've yet known. What is the first thing people will say?
That Churchill is to blame.
Possibly. But also that such things must be expected with a Hun as First Sea Lord. I'm accused even now of sending information to the Kaiser.
I'm deeply sorry about all this, Prince Louis.
Oh, it doesn't matter. Did we not agree 3 months ago that the individual is unimportant at such a time? I know what is best, my friend. And therefore, I must say goodbye to you.
What a pity. What a terrible pity. Especially as I can't replace you. I don't know one man I could ask.
One, surely, despite his age.
Fisher?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you're right, Prince Louis. He's the only possible choice. But I shall miss you, my friend.
Miss me? You won't have time. You'll never have time to be aware that I'm not by your side.
The Dardanelles, a name which brings to mind a picture of gallant men fighting an heroic battle. Gallipoli, a name dear to many as the scene of the Anzac's glorious feat of arms. How did this grim and great story begin? Who wrote the prologue to the Dardanelles and Gallipoli? This is how it began. At the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, First Lord, discusses military and naval operations with the new First Sea Lord, the redoubtable Lord Fisher.
John, I just had a talk with Kitchener. He showed me a telegram he just received from Russia. The Grand Duke's rather worried about Turkish movements in the Caucasus. He asks if it wouldn't be possible to give them something else to think about.
What's that got to do with us?
Well, Kitchener thinks we might be able to stage a demonstration in the Dardanelles.
There he got rid of Font Spey for us. He might be able to force the Dardanelles with the Majestic class and the Canopus class.
I suggested an attack on Gallipoli. I wanted to do that on the declaration of war, but Kitchener says he has no troops to spare.
No, France. He could replace all Indians and 75,000 seasoned troops with territorials and embark a Turkish expeditionary force from Marseilles.
You're in favor of action against the Turks, then?
Absolutely. I believe Bulgaria is the key to the situation. The Balkans must be rallied. But whatever we must do must be done quickly. As Napoleon said, celerity, without it, failure.
If Kitchener refuses to supply troops, we shall have to see what the Navy alone can do. I'll telegraph Admiral Carton immediately, asking the possibility.
Winston, I don't think we should proceed with this Dardanelles business.
What?
I'm against the proposed bombardment and blocking in of Zeebrugge, too.
What's caused this sudden change?
I've been thinking things over. And I believe we shouldn't weaken the Grand Fleet.
You've been listening to what Jellicoe says.
Well, Jellicoe's the commander-in-chief, isn't he? If we don't listen to him, we shall listen to no one.
Jellicoe's a good man, but he's concerned primarily with his own fleet. We have to take the broad view.
The safety of the Grand Fleet should be our main purpose.
In November, John, you advised the removal of Princess Royal, Inflexible and Invincible, together with 8 King Edwards and 5 Duncans, a total of 16 capital ships from the Grand Fleet for permanent service in the south. Since then, Jellicoe has increased his strength, and yet when ships are wanted for a major operation, you say he can't spare any.
Not for a coastal bombardment. Our job is to gain command of the sea.
Our job is to win the war. I'm sorry, John, but this is one occasion when you must be overruled.
Then I refuse to attend tomorrow's meeting of the War Council.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Ridiculous or not, I won't attend.
But why?
Because I have no desire to continue a useless resistance to plans in which I cannot concur.
Lord Fisher, as First Sea Lord, you must attend.
Is that a request for my resignation?
Certainly not. It's a request for your cooperation. I can't attend the War Council without you.
Now, you're sure my presence won't help you in the least?
If I arrange a private meeting for both of us with the Prime Minister before the Council begins, will that help?
Provided you forward him in advance a memorandum, which I intend to write immediately.
Very well. And I shall also forward my own memorandum, written in answer to yours.
Good. I shall see you in Mr. Asquith's room, then.
20 minutes before the War Council begins.
I have read your memorandum, Lord Fisher, and fully appreciate the points you have raised. But in my opinion, the First Lord has answered your arguments very fully, and I may say, to my complete satisfaction.
Then it's no use my attending the War Council.
On the contrary, there are many points to be discussed which require your expert knowledge.
I'm strongly opposed to both the Zeebrugge and Dardanelles schemes. I would prefer a great operation in the Baltic, or a general advance of the army along the Belgian coast, with strong naval support.
Your sole reason is that set forth in your memorandum?
Yes.
You don't criticize the Gallipoli attack on its own particular merits?
No.
And you, Mr. Churchill, you are of the opinion that both the Zeebrugge and the Dardanelles scheme should be undertaken?
Yes, but if either is to be dropped, I believe it should be Zeebrugge.
Well, now we all know where we stand. Shall we proceed to the meeting of the War Council?
Very well, Mr.
I therefore communicated to the Grand Duke Nicholas and to the French Admiralty the project for a naval attack on the Dardanelles. The Grand Duke replied with enthusiasm and stated that he believed the attack might assist him considerably. The French Admiralty has also sent a favorable reply and has promised cooperation. Preparations are in hand for commencing about the middle of February. Does the War Council attach importance to this operation, which undoubtedly involves some risks?
I understood that this question would not be raised today. The Prime Minister is well aware of my own views in regard to it.
I would remind Lord Fisher that in view of the steps already taken, the question could not well be left in abeyance. What does Lord Kitchener think?
A naval attack is vitally important. If successful, its effect would be equivalent to that of a successful campaign fought with the new armies. The particular merit of the scheme is that if satisfactory progress is not made, the attack can be broken off.
Mr. Balfour.
I believe that a successful attack on the Dardanelles would achieve these results. We'll cut the Turkish army in two. We'll put Constantinople under our control. It would give us the advantage of having the Russian wheat and enable Russia to resume exports. It would restore the Russian exchanges. It would open a passage to the Danube. In short, it would be difficult to imagine a more potentially helpful operation.
Sir Edward Grey.
I am not satisfied that it would be successful.
The naval commander-in-chief of the Mediterranean has expressed the belief that it can be done. It requires from 3 weeks to a month to accomplish it. The ships required are already on their way.
You said the operation involves risks, Mr. Churchill. Will you enlarge on that?
I do not anticipate much loss in the actual bombardment, but in sweeping for mines, some losses must be expected. The real difficulties will begin after the outer forts have been silenced and it becomes necessary to attack the narrows.
Why has Lord Fisher left the council table? And Lord Kitchener?
You're the only one not in favor, Fisher. The whole thing's decided. It's your duty to carry on.
Is anything the matter, Lord Kitchener?
No, no. Everything's all right. Isn't it, Fisher?
Yes. Everything's all right.
Good. Then let us proceed. You were saying, Mr. Churchill.
This is the plan of attack.
Of the Dardanelles, soon to be followed by the glorious story of Gallipoli, begins. This is the history of the undertaking, so grim and great. The words of a contemporary biographer are always to be remembered in Winston Churchill's association with this venture. The responsibility for the failure at the Dardanelles does not rest on Churchill. The campaign came within an ace of success. It would have ended the war in 1915, but for the mismanagement, the irresolution, and the infirmity of others. Had Churchill been given a free hand, the Dardanelles would surely have been forced. First, he was told by the War Office that no troops were available and that the Navy must force the Dardanelles by itself. Then troops were sent, but in insufficient numbers. And Winston Churchill, a bitterly disappointed man at the frustration of his plans, was to be made the chief culprit for many years. But he has learned to suffer the attacks of enemies and to prove ultimately the breadth of his vision and the sagacity of his foresight. This, the man who today is imperial leader.